is okay. Thank you very much, Venerable Konveve Arya Ratna Thera, for the introduction. And the head of the Vihara was trying his best to avoid attending this Mataka Bana, but he couldn't avoid it. I think just like the death, which we don't know when it will occur. So there we are. We are all, as somebody said just now, that we are all waiting in the God's waiting room, waiting for the call. Yeah, departure lounge, as they call it. I must, first of all, pay my heartfelt gratitude and regards to the most venerable Bogota Sila Vimala Sanghanayaka Thera, and thank him for giving me this opportunity to talk to you about my new book. We are our minds, not our brains, the Buddha discovered, and to set out in brief some of the novel ideas it contains. I was very late that day coming to present the book to the Venerable Sanghanayaka. Instead of blaming me for being too late, he said that he was not able to offer me a cup of tea because he had to go out to attend to a pre-arranged task which needed to be done before the end of that day. That clearly demonstrated the nature of real loving kindness practiced by a true Buddhist venerable, like that of our Sanghanayaka Thera. After sending me an email this morning, he spoke to me again about his disappointment for not being able to be present, but he wanted a copy of my talk delivered to him as soon as I finish it. Friends keep asking me over and over again what motivates me to write and where the ideas come from. Of course, writing keeps me out of mischief, no doubt. That is not really true. I am too old for any mischief now. Seriously, folks, the motivation is to let the world know what I know, and the ideas come from thinking, which the Buddha encouraged us to do in his advice to the Kalamas. He said not to accept even his own teachings. First time in the history of any religion, the leader saying, "Don't believe what I say until you test it and find their usefulness to our well-being." I recently heard a true story about thinking. Henry Ford, one of the biggest car manufacturers in America, once instructed a management consultant to identify those who were idling, not doing their full quota of work, because he wanted to sack them all. The specialist noticed one person in the office doing absolutely nothing but sipping tea. So he immediately reported the man to Henry Ford. Henry Ford shouted, "No, not him. I can't sack him because I have employed him only to think and come forward with new ideas to improve production." That shows how important thinking is. 2 years ago now, I read a highly acclaimed bestseller. The title is "We Are Our Brains" by the world-renowned Professor Dick Swab, and it started me thinking. His view was diametrically opposite to what the Buddha said 2600 years ago, after subjecting his mind to the highest possible scrutiny humanly possible, and having achieved supreme refinement of his mind to gain enlightenment. The more I thought about it, the clearer it became to me that the professor has put the cart before the horse. I was 100% convinced that we are not our brains, having remembered the three words said to have escaped the lips of the Buddha immediately after his enlightenment. The three words were Visankara Gatam Chittam. Chitta means the mind. Those were the three words that escaped the mind, the lips of the Buddha. When you translate the three words into English, it reads as, it is liberated. The Buddha did not cry out, I am liberated, but instead proudly declared that it is liberated, which meant very clearly that it was his mind he liberated. Having gained enlightenment to experience the supreme bliss of Nirvana, only by liberating his mind from the conditioned, that is Sankara, to become unconditioned Visankara, the Buddha liberated his mind from being reborn ever again in a time-limited conditioned physical body. The words of the Buddha, it is liberated, unambiguously referred to his impersonal, intangible, and elusive mind, making it absolutely clear that there is nothing in human existence other than the mind, around which, of course, a series of impersonal processes take place, and that there is no permanent hardcore whatsoever that could be identified as self. I, me, mine, that each one of us used to identify ourselves as individuals, the Buddha said, was a total illusion. This truth is incontrovertible, in my view. Furthermore, in the doctrine of dependent origination, the Buddha's outstanding contribution to humanity, he did not say that dependent on consciousness, there are of course 12 steps, depending on consciousness, there arises a human being or life, but only, he said, impersonal name and form, mentality and materiality, mind and matter. There is no life in it. This I understand perfectly, in that there is no one called I, but only processes which are preceded by the mind, created by the mind, and led by the mind. For example, there is giving and receiving, but there is no one is giving, no one giving or no one receiving. This is the truth. Think about it and it will dawn on you, the truth. What did the Buddha do or use to discover this truth? Definitely not the Large Hadron Collider, but only his mind and practicing insight meditation, which he himself discovered to elevate his mind to its pristine purity and radiance by removing every conceivable pollutant that defiled his mind. In his first sermon to the 5 ascetic friends, the Buddha explained that when his mind was completely cleared of all pollutants, light arose in him, which was not known to him before. And that luminous mind alone allowed him access to the fundamental nature of reality, to experience nirvana. What were the pollutants that defiled the mind of the Buddha? They were the main emotions of greed, hatred, delusion, and their derivatives, like envy, jealousy, ill will, malice, distrust, animosity, and hostility, which, as we all know very well, are incapable of arising anywhere in the universe, but only in human minds. If you think about it, even for a moment, you will realize that they are indeed the root causes of human misery. As I was convinced beyond all reasonable doubt, I decided to write, "We Are Our Minds, Not Our Brains," highlighting the superiority of the mind. But before sending it to the publisher, I took the precaution to wait until a piece of evidence became available from the contemporary digital world that could make what I was going to say convincing to the modern reader. This was because it would have been very risky to go against the established view of cognitive neuroscientists without some convincing evidence which everybody could relate to. The view of the scientists, as you all know, was that consciousness and mind were both emergent properties of the whole brain activity, which meant that the brain manufactured both consciousness and mind. The piece of evidence that I was waiting for came when Professor Daniel Dennett, the world-renowned researcher on brain, consciousness, and mind, said at a Royal Institution lecture here in London that the most appropriate analogy that can be used to understand the brain and mind was the modern computer, this laptop. He said that the human brain was an organic computer. The network of neurons in the brain was the hardware, and the energy of the mind was the software operating in that hardware. Furthermore, this is a very important part of it. Furthermore, in his view, the network of neurons in our physical brain was just like a termite colony, a bottom-up operation where individual termites worked without knowing what they were exactly doing. They were doing just like neurons, their work. That's about it. And their efficiency was due to the complete absence of an overall boss in the colony. You may have heard that in a termite colony, there is no boss. They all work together. They don't know what they are doing. It is the same with the neurons in the brain. They don't know what they are doing. They are processes. He said that the human brain was an organic computer and the network. I take it that all of you are conversant with computers and also used to download information from the World Wide Web. Your brains are right now downloading the information I create, disturbing the particles in the emptiness by the sounds of the words I am speaking. The World Wide Web for your brains is the emptiness from which you keep downloading information using your brain, the software, operating the network of neurons in your brain. Right now, you are downloading the information I am putting into the emptiness. Using the same comparison, it is correct for me to say that the fabric of space-time, right in front of my eyes, i.e. the outside world, you see, is very similar to the figures and images that appear in the computer monitor. Looking at the computer monitor is exactly like looking at the outside world using your eyes. It was very comforting for me to note that the Daily Mirror article about my book, which was very kindly reproduced in New Sri Lanka, highlighted the computer terminology to attract the attention of the modern day reader. The article started with the words, "To lead the life of a rational human being, the imperative is not the brain, the hardware, but the software of the conscious mind working in good order." This digital age narrative seems to have caught the eye of the editor of Daily Mirror, as well as the editors of Google, because even today, after 2 months, if you go into Google, they are showing the book, even after 2 months, which is very, very unusual. Having mentioned computers, which were developed using quantum mechanics, it is incumbent upon me, I think, to dwell more, a little bit more, on the aspects of quantum mechanics, which I consider relevant to the better understanding of Buddhism, and also its intimate connection with the human being. Only a few years ago now, leading scientists of the world built the most expensive machine, the Large Hadron Collider, costing billions of pounds, in Geneva, Switzerland, to explore what existed during the first fraction of a second after the Big Bang. It revealed the existence of many subatomic particles, including the elusive Higgs boson. But the latest revelation is that there is absolutely nothing but emptiness, which the Buddha found 2,600 years ago, using only his radiant mind, seated under the Bodhi tree in India. I do not think the Buddha spent any money at all to find that truth, because he did not handle money. What he found was entirely due to his dogged determination, monumental personal effort to find the truth. For the first time in living memory, it was the Buddha who mentioned emptiness in his teaching. In the Buddhist insight meditation, which many of you have practiced, with the Buddha himself discovered, there are 8 jhanas, or absorptions, to be completed before reaching enlightenment. Beyond the penultimate 7th jhana, there is only nothingness or emptiness. There is nothing. Only in the 20th century, with the development of quantum mechanics, scientists found that the ground state of the universe was the quantum vacuum, which was a very posh scientific word for emptiness. When you say that there is only emptiness to describe the world you see full of wonderful things, people sometimes get offended. Once I almost lost my long-standing good friends because of the word emptiness I mentioned. My friends are a church-going, God-fearing, decent Christian couple. During a lengthy conversation, I said, "In reality, what we are doing is only empty people. We are empty people doing empty things in empty space." To which his wife of my friend took umbrage and shouted, "That is absolute rubbish. I am here to do my God's will, and certainly not doing empty things, but trying to create his kingdom on earth to the best of my ability." That reply did not come to me as a complete surprise, because they are unswearing belief in the Almighty God. I said that they should not totally dismiss what I said, but contemplate on it, because it was the naked truth and nothing to do with any religion. My friend later ran to say that there was some truth in what I said, but made no further comments. To find out whether emptiness is really empty, I would like to make a real-time example. Take a biscuit in your palm of your hand and crush it into pieces. And if you continue to do so, making the pieces progressively smaller and smaller, a stage will soon be reached where the pieces will become too small to be seen with the naked eye. That means the pieces have reached the size of atoms. Your solid biscuit will then only be a heap of invisible atoms. In exactly the same way, the entire universe could be crushed or pulverized, reducing it to atoms or particles. The universe in its entirety will then only be empty space, but filled with invisible particles. We call this emptiness filled with particles the quantum realm, and the larger bodies like biscuits made out of those particles the classical realm. These are the only two realms in the universe. Energy quantum, matter classical. However, they are two manifestations of one and the same thing, cosmic energy. The universe is only energy, and each one of you and me is nothing but a time-limited dancing pattern of that energy. As we have found the space around us not empty at all, but full of particles, and in fact, it is the repository of all energy, the likes of universal gravity, electromagnetic spectrum, radio, and sound waves. The entire energy content of the universe is in this empty space, which we call emptiness. The biscuit that you held in your palm of the hand is matter. It can be seen, felt, eaten, held in your hand, given to a friend, or thrown away, knowing beforehand where the biscuit will fall. But you cannot do any of them with particles, because they are so weird in their behavior that a particle could be in two places at once and can also behave both like a particle and a wave. Although the computer, the mobile telephone, and other digital technologies were developed using quantum mechanics, no one really understands how it actually works. An interesting story from the time of the Buddha, I am sure, will put emptiness in the proper context. Once the Buddha held a flower in his hand and asked the audience to describe it. Descriptions came thick and fast from all directions. They said that it was a lotus flower with beautiful petals, pink in color, the stem had thorns, grew in the mud, in shallow water lakes, and of course many other descriptive aspects of the flower. And to surprise all, there was an arahant in the audience, an enlightened being. He said that he saw the lotus flower, beautiful petals, long stem, lotus seeds, mud, nutrients, water, earth. heat, light, sun, moon, solar system, universe, and emptiness. I hope you will be able to remember this story from this day forward, because it encapsulates the essence of Buddhism. You go to the root of it. That is what it is all the time. If the whole universe is only emptiness with particles, your body and life, forming an integral part of that emptiness, must obviously be formed of particles as well. As we all know, our bodies are only made up of particles, but every single one of us began life as a particle, a single cell in our mother's wombs. As you will no doubt appreciate, therefore, having started life as a single particle, it is impossible for us to ignore either the quantum realm or the quantum reality. A human DNA chromosome, starting life as an invisible single particle, becomes a fetus, a fully grown human body, within a period of 9 months. By the process of cell division, one cell replicating and becoming millions of cells. There are about 100 trillion cells in a typical human body. It is said that the only burning ambition of a cell is to make another cell. There are even more reasons why emptiness is of critical importance to our survival as human beings. For us to operate with maximum efficiency, our 5 senses must keep supplying us with information about our habitat, our immediate external environment. Of the 5 senses, vision is the one that is absolutely vital. It is our ability to see everything with our naked eyes. As you know, we can only see the external environment when photons of light, which are the particles of light, enter our eyes. But they are only particles of light and do not mean anything at all to us until they are converted into 3-dimensional images in color that our awareness can recognize. What is it that converts the stream of particles entering our eyes into images that our awareness can recognize? This miracle is performed by our conscious minds in conjunction with the energy of karma deposits in the wave frequency that each one of us is operating within it. What is performed is one of the most important functions enshrined in quantum mechanics, the collapse of the quantum wave function. It is not very big. It sounds big, but it is not. Our minds and karma deposits keep performing this function in respect of all senses and keep doing so during our entire lifespan as a human being. Collapse of the quantum wave function could easily be understood by the famous thought experiment. Imagine a cat locked inside the box containing a virulent form of lethal poison, which, if activated, could kill the cat. So when the box remained shut, there are at least 2 possible quantum states. Either the cat is alive or cat is dead. Only by opening the lid and looking inside the box, we could see a definite result. A living cat or a dead cat. The 2 quantum possibilities have therefore collapsed into one definite result. That is what is called the collapse of the quantum wave function. The particles that were coming to our eyes, they were converted into three-dimensional figures in color that we can recognize by this collapse of the quantum wave function. This is the collapse of the wave function that our conscious minds perform, proving the vital importance of the quantum realm, which enables us to operate as human beings. Also, it is important to understand that only the mind possesses the capacity to function both in realms of quantum and classical. When formulating a thought in your mind, thinking, the mind operates in the quantum realm. You can't see it. But when converting that very thought into action, the mind operates in the classical realm. Only the mind has this incredible ability to operate in both realms. This makes it absolutely clear that your physical naked eyes on their own cannot see. Your ears on their own cannot hear. And your nose on its own cannot smell. So is with the other senses. It is because all those functions are performed by your mind. Without your mind in good working order, the images you see, the sounds you hear, and the smells you smell will not make any sense at all, unless interpreted, coordinated, and translated by the mind. We see this in real life, watching our relatives and friends who were so unfortunate as to suffer from loss of mind due to amnesia, dementia, or any other type of mental impairment. About 20 years ago now, our next door neighbor, a retired organist instructor at Royal College of Church Music, knocked on our door instead of ringing the bell and wanted me to try the key to her front door as she had accidentally locked herself out. By her not ringing the bell, doorbell, as usual, made me think that there is something urgent or has gone wrong. I accompanied her to her front door and found the door wide open. You can just imagine my amazement. I knew immediately that something was very badly wrong. I escorted her inside the house, sat her down, and prepared a cup of tea and rang her daughter, who arrived a few hours later. Her daughter greeted me first and said, "Hello, Mummy," to her mum. To which her mum promptly replied, "Do I know you?" We both were horror-struck, to say the least, hearing that, and knew that something was very, very seriously wrong. This highlights what I said before, that our eyes and ears do not see and hear without the mind in good working order. The old lady saw her own daughter, but could not recognize her as such, without the mind in good working order. That was what was missing. Not her eyesight or hearing. The poor lady was later admitted to a nursing home as she needed round-the-clock care. As a result of losing her mind, she ceased to be an independent operational unit of a human being, although her consciousness was completely intact and unimpaired. The imperative, therefore, for a human body to operate as a rational human being is not consciousness, but a mind working in good order. Let me now turn to consciousness and mind, the two cardinal forces of the emptiness keeping us, every one of us, alive and active, enabling us to behave as independent and operational units of rational human beings. Consciousness, in my view, is very different from the mind. This is because consciousness is a property of fundamental particles in the emptiness, and therefore static, unchangeable, and omnipresent. It's everywhere. Consciousness is not an evolved faculty by natural selection like the mind. Where there is emptiness, there are particles. Where there are particles, there is consciousness. And as emptiness pervades the whole wide universe, consciousness is everywhere and common to all living beings. You may have seen on TV a massive roaring African elephant falling to the ground when shot with a tranquilized dart and remaining lifeless until an antidote is administered. What the elephant loses is the same life-giving energy of consciousness that we lose when we are put under an anesthetic, proving that consciousness is common to all beings. There are no living beings without physical bodies. We all agree that. Physical bodies occupy emptiness. That emptiness is filled with particles. It is the consciousness inherent in those particles that energizes our bodies with consciousness. Also, more importantly, it is this consciousness that micromanages the internal environment of our living bodies, to which none of us have access. You do not know what is going on inside your body at any particular given point in time, because it is on automatic pilot, micromanaged by consciousness, and it is the same with the internal workings of all living beings. I think you will agree with me that when I say that, only a supreme intelligence like that of the cosmic consciousness has the capacity to manage the extremely complicated and complex mechanisms we have inside our bodies. When we die and disappear, we leave behind the empty space that we once occupied, which energized us with consciousness. When a living being is put under an anesthetic, what happens is that consciousness goes back into the particles in the space that living body is occupying, only to return when the anesthetic loses its potency. Only consciousness has this unique ability or flexibility to move to and from a living body, simply because it is the property of fundamental particles. The Buddha explained in his philosophy, using the law of cause and effect, he predicated all his philosophy on the law of cause and effect. Accordingly, arising of certain conditions, the cause, gives rise to arising of other phenomena, the effect. The ideal conditions, for example, for forest fires in Australia are dry weather, fanned by oxygen-rich gusts of wind, low relative humidity, and trees accidentally rubbing against each other, providing the tinder. The inevitable consequence of those conditions coming into being can only be fire. The phenomenon of fire is completely and utterly different to the conditions that brought it about. Equally, the ideal condition for full-blown consciousness to manifest in a human brain is when its neurons are oscillating quantum coherently, reaching a frequency of 40 hertz. When the oscillations fall below this frequency, the brain loses consciousness. The variations in neuronal oscillations, therefore, guarantees flexibility. And that piece of scientific research is consistent with what the Buddha said. When certain conditions have come about, other conditions also come about. That is what cause and effect is all about. In my view, there are only two possibilities in consciousness. A human being is either conscious or alive, or unconscious and dead. There cannot be any altered states of consciousness in between. As many neuroscientists have told me and are also preaching everywhere, there are altered states of consciousness. Only the mind is capable of having altered states. Each time a pollutant, such as hatred, is expelled permanently from a mind, that mind is elevated to a serene and peaceful state. The human mind can think. The human mind that can think is completely different from consciousness. This is my view. Mind is not omnipresent like consciousness. It is not everywhere. Mind is an evolved faculty by natural selection and consequently personal and private to each human being. Animals do have minds, but their minds cannot think. Having a mind that can think, we can commit suicide. But an animal cannot, because they cannot think. Have you ever heard of an animal who has committed suicide? Although physical brains are identical in all human beings, thinking is different. Because the mind that each one of us inherits is different. It is the mind that is different, not the brain. When a human being loses consciousness without any hope of being resuscitated, he or she is completely dead. But losing the mind, for example, patients suffering from memory loss, amnesia, Alzheimer's, and dementia, a human being does not die, but ceases to be an independent operational unit of a human being. That is more important than consciousness. This is my view anyway. If therefore one cannot operate as an independent human being without the mind in good working order, what is of paramount importance is not the consciousness, but the human mind that can think. Believe you me when I tell you that I was not able to find a single religious leader other than the Buddha who provided a clear and understandable definition of the human mind. The Buddha's definition goes back 2,600 years and enshrined in the Dhammapada. His definition was clear, concise, accurate, because he understood the human mind perfectly, having subjected it to the most rigorous scrutiny. The Buddha said that the mind has no physical body. Now we know mind is a form of energy and therefore incapable of having a body. The Buddha said that the mind lived in an empty cave. Now we know that the mind operates in the emptiness. The Buddha said the mind worked all alone. The mind only works with you and no one else. No one has access to your mind and no one knows what you have in your mind. The Buddha said that the mind had the unique capacity to walk long distances, leaving behind the body. Mind can do that because unlike the human body, mind is not circumscribed by time or space, which gives it the capacity to roam around anywhere and everywhere at any time, day or night. Neuroscientists and philosophers are still struggling to come up with an accurate definition of the mind. The latest definition compiled by a group of eminent American scientists goes like this. Mind is an embodied relational process that regulates the flow of energy and information. This may be a modern definition of the mind, but it does not mean very much to me at all. I remember my friend phoning me to say that on certain occasions he would go up to his bedroom to get something urgently. But by the time he got to his bedroom, he has forgotten what he came up for. I said, join the club. It was even worse with me because I sometimes forget even before I reach the bedroom. This is what you are. You are only your mind. The moment you lose the proper working of your mind, you become disorientated, not knowing where you are going or what you are doing. Of course, during the momentary loss of your mind, even for that short time, your consciousness continues and remains unchanged and intact because you can see, you can hear, you can eat, you can drink, you can walk, you can sleep, and have the ability to digest the food you eat. Your mind is personal and private, as I said before, because it is continuously being energized by the energy of karma, deposits embedded in your unique wave frequency you brought forward from a previous existence. Given the opportunity, I am pretty certain youngsters of his age would have given an arm and a leg to be born Prince George. Prince George, we know, will never be called upon to do a day's work to earn a living. All his needs not only will be supplied but delivered to him by those employed to serve him. This is the great miracle of karma. His birth alone guaranteed him the life of pomp, glory, and circumstance. For a long time, I myself harbored my own disbelief, serious doubts about karma. But after learning that the Buddha had based his entire philosophy on the law of cause and effect, and having tested its veracity, employing my own simple methods, I found that the law really works. And therefore, what the Buddha said must be also true. If I were to abuse anybody sitting right here with using bad words, I'll be looking at a very unhappy face. By the same token, if I were to praise him or her using very kind and pleasant words, I'll be looking at a very happy face. If I were to punch this lectern with my fist, severe pain in my fist will be the unavoidable result. In the former, I used only words. In the latter, I used physical contact. But in each case, a cause yielded an effect. And the effect always came after the cause. This is very important. It was only the Buddha in all human history who not only declared that in the ethical world, nothing can arise without a prior cause, but also predicated his whole philosophy on the law of cause and effect. Here comes the punchline. Would you believe that the final and definitive confirmation that law of cause and effect is absolutely true comes from nowhere else but from the most revered, venerated 20th century scientific theory, the theory of relativity, formulated by Albert Einstein, who won the Nobel Prize for photoelectric effect, the forerunner of quantum theory. Albert Einstein proved for the first time in the history of theoretical physics that the speed of light was a constant, 186,000 miles per second. And under no circumstances it can be varied. The only constant in the world, therefore, is the speed of light. If the speed of light was not a constant, but a variable, it would be possible for us to know the effect before the cause. As a direct consequence of that, the Buddhist philosophy predicated on cause and effect would have completely collapsed and fallen apart, literally fallen apart. The Buddha's true greatness is demonstrated here by the fact that his omniscient mind saw what one of the greatest scientists of all time could prove only in the 20th century. His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and many other scholars have confirmed that karma, the dynamics of karma, are known only to an omniscient mind of a Sammasambuddha and to nobody else. That is the problem we have with karma. This being the case, the only way for us mere mortals to comprehend karma is to accept that the power behind the operation of karma is the watertight law of cause and effect, which guarantees that whenever, wherever a cause comes into existence, its effect is completely unavoidable and will definitely take place either in this birth or in any other future births. I think it is important for me to repeat what the Buddha said in summary form about karma. He said, karma is the womb from which I have sprung. I am the owner of my karma. I am the heir to my karma. Karma is my relation. Karma is my protection. Whatever karma I do, good or bad, of these I shall become heir. This summary puts it beyond all doubt that our minds are creators of the energy of karma, and in turn we are made by our own karma. We are embodiments of actions. Doing things using mind, speech, and body are actions. Eating, drinking, thinking, reading, speaking, looking, moving, body or limb are all actions. And they all create karma deposits, the energy of which in turn energizes our minds. This is the rolling phenomenon of human existence. There are only actions and absolutely nothing else. We do these actions immersed in the emptiness, filled with particles. Our actions, no matter how insignificant they may be, disturb these particles, creating energy in the form of waves. Right now, I am creating energy in the form of waves by speaking and disturbing the particles around me. This energy I create is recorded as a karma deposit in my unique wave frequency. The truth that each one of us operates in a unique frequency is confirmed by the fact that each one of us has a unique voice, and a voice can only be modulated using a wave frequency. The empty space around you is absolutely jam-packed with energy of emptiness. You can test this truth right now by switching on your mobile and logging on to the Google. Where was the information about Google before you switched your mobile on? It was present in here, in the room, in the empty space, right in front of you, as an invisible radio wave frequency. And it has been there ever since Google started transmitting programs using a particular electromagnetic radio wave frequency. This is exactly what the network of neurons in your brain does. It downloads energy from your unique frequency right in front of you and uploads energy created by your actions. Majority of your actions are done in the classical realm of larger bodies, but the energy they create is in the quantum realm because they are vibrations of particles. Energy is a quantum phenomenon. It can only be recorded in the quantum realm. And when the energy of your action is recorded in a wave frequency, it is called, in my opinion, a karma deposit. Once recorded, a karma deposit belongs to the emptiness, not to you. You are the creator, but not to you. Recordings of karma deposits are free from human error because they are performed by emptiness. As you will no doubt appreciate, energy of karma cannot be recorded in the neurons of our perishable, constantly changing physical brains. Neurons are only machines, the hardware, just like your iPhone. iPhones only process information. They cannot manufacture them. Likewise, neurons process information back and forth from wave frequencies, downloading energy of karma and uploading the actions of energy of your actions. Neurons are also responsible for downloading and masterminding the life-giving energy of consciousness, the management of the internal environments in our body, which may include instinctual responses, just like instantly removing your hand from a hot oven. You don't have to engage your mind on that one. As you will no doubt appreciate, it would have been impossible to use words download and upload if not for the advent of the computer and the iPhone developed using the principles of quantum mechanics. I have only a page or two to go. I know it is getting very late. Your intentional action this evening to come to London Buddhist Vihara is now only a karma deposit recorded in your own mind wave frequency. You cannot erase it or alter it in any way because that action is now energy, a quantum phenomenon, and no longer belongs to you but to emptiness. Although it lies beyond your control, you can still recall it in detail at any time in the future. And the beneficial effects of your coming today will continue to influence your life from this day forward. Recordings, by definition, are absolutely accurate, especially the recordings of faces of people, because they are vital to civilized living. If you cannot, for example, recognize your own mother by looking at her face, you will agree that civilized living would be simply impossible. This means that there must be a network of neurons dedicated to the processing of people's faces recorded in our unique frequencies. There is a very amusing story in Professor Dixob's book where a man suffering from prosopagnosia, a disease that affects the neurons dealing with face recognition. He was able to clearly identify his Ford Fiesta, but not his wife. So that would have, you can just imagine the scene that would have created. But of course, he could have recognized his wife by listening to her voice, because the neurons dealing with the processing of voice or sound were in good working order. If you look back on your own life, it will become extremely clear that your life today is the result of your intentional actions or karma of your past. Like, for example, passing the driving test, getting good marks in those final examinations. It was the energy of those karma deposits that is fashioning your life right now. And your current actions, no doubt, in the same way, will be guiding the rest of your life here. And by inference, maybe your future births or lives. Only by practicing insight meditation, which requires only time and effort, the Buddha was able to eliminate all pollutants from his mind. This is what you must try and practice every day, devoting at least 10 minutes. As soon as you get up from bed and immediately before going back to bed, very soon thereafter, you will begin to feel the beneficial effects. If you think about it for a moment, it will dawn on you that it is all in the mind and not anywhere else. Having thought about it, are you able to right now to imagine what a mind would be like when completely and utterly free from greed, hatred and delusion? This is the mind of the Buddha. I am sure it is virtually impossible for us even to imagine a mind like that. The quality of such a mind, because such a mind would have transcended humanness. The iPhone, without which modern life is almost impossible, was developed thanks to the initial work done by Albert Einstein on quantum mechanics. He developed his theories without conducting any experiments in a laboratory, using only his incisive thinking mind, just like the Buddha did 2,600 years ago, seated under a tree, using only his mind. The majesty of the human mind that can think is therefore insuperable. Listening to a talk like this, there must be at least one useful item you can take home. Cause and effect would be a good one, I think. Knowing perfectly well that it is the absolute truth. As it is impossible for us to opt out of this law, you must try to avoid creating causes like to yield undesirable effects. Your mind, your only bona fide lifelong companion, the keeper of your inner most likes, dislikes and secrets, will keep churning out thoughts, but it needs only your body, speech and limbs to put them into practice, more into action. This is where you have complete control. By refraining from executing any actions you think that is likely to create bad causes, you eliminate its corresponding effect altogether. Once this practice takes root in your mind, it will begin to deliver answers to all your problems, stresses and strains. The answers you are seeking are always within you, in your own mind, the software that is operating in your brain. What is important, therefore, is to improve the software, your mind, to which no one else but only you have access. Thank you for listening. It has taken a long time, but there's a lot to get through. And mobile phone, iPhone, computer makes Buddhism come alive, honestly. There's no other way to explain it. And I was surprised that cause and effect finally was completely exonerated or proved beyond all reasonable doubt by the greatest theory of all time, the relativity theory, which said that speed of light cannot change. If speed of light was a variable, you could know the effect before the cause, which is impossible. If that has been the case, then Buddhism has no place at all. His philosophy just collapses and disappears. But, I mean, it took a lot of time to discover all this, but it's all there. That is why that book, I was told, has gone viral. Not because of anything else. It's very simple. Did I talk anything about anything that you can't understand? Maybe the collapse of the quantum wave function. It is so easy. That is what our eyes, ears, smells are doing. If your mind is not there, you may be watching. Certainly you don't know what you are watching. It is the mind that puts everything, decodes, it translates, and it does everything. It is your mind. Consciousness is, there are two states, either you are dead or alive. But mind, the moment the mind goes, you cease to become a human being. That is the problem. You see, you are just a lump of flesh. I mean, that lady, our next door neighbor, I mean, such an intelligent woman. Her daughter said, hello, mommy. And he said, do I know you? I mean, it's unbelievable. It came as an absolute shock. That is what it is. The moment you lose that little bit called the energy of the mind, you cease to exist as a human being. But your consciousness is there. You can eat, drink, do all kinds of things. But you don't know what you are doing without the mind. That is where the mind is so important. That's why I have devoted 3 years to write that. But it's very simple. As you can see, it's very simple. But yet it's so profound. I mean, do you see the difference between when you lose consciousness, you are dead. When you lose the mind, you cease to exist as a human being. Yeah? That is the problem. And cognitive scientists and neuroscientists that I have read, I've read a few bit, they all say that just like the urine comes from the kidneys produce the urine, your brain produces consciousness and mind. I mean, it's unbelievable. If not for what the Buddha uttered soon after his enlightenment, Visankhara Gatang Chittang. It is liberated, not me. My mind is liberated. You are only your mind, nothing else. As that old lady, you know, it was a stark reality, absolutely hit on the head. Hello, mommy, do I know you? I mean, how do you feel if your mom were to address you? Yeah. No, they have minds, but they can't think. Otherwise, the only difference is, for example, I mean, that is my only example. Have you ever heard of an animal committing suicide? Can't, because he can't think. And well, it is very difficult to argue karma with them, but the evolution is, I have drawn a pyramid of life, observable pyramid of life. In that life, it's good that you asked that question. At the bottom, there are the microscopic animals in the soil, like worms and all kinds of tiny little living organisms. If those organisms, this is what A.E., the greatest scientist of all time from Harvard University, he says, there are billions of creatures in a handful of soil. We don't know what they are doing. But the moment they stop doing that, we are at risk. The bees and all this, and pyramid, at the bottom are those worms and things like that in the soil. They are in billions. And then the next layer is other creatures. And then the next layer is bees and all that. And then the other layer is gradually they are reducing in their numbers. And also there is heterogenesis in the sense that there are various number of, with bees there are so many other little animals. And as you go up, there are elephants and there are whales. Those are the biggest animals. And they are very few. And that is how it is. And we are right at the top. And we are homogeneous. We are all the same. Looks the same. So these animals, in the end, will end up in the human kingdom. That's what I think. They have their karma as well. I mean, there are dogs. Without them, there are so many people who are blind. They just can't operate, can they? Without these animals, so they are performing a very laudable service to humanity, and they are very close to humans, I suppose. You know, I mean, the within chimpanzee and us, only the DNA is only, we are 98% of our DNA is them, only two percentage points which differ from each other. So we are so close in that pyramid of life. Everything is dependent on the other. Now, if bees were to vanish, that is what Albert Einstein said, at any point, given point in time, that is the end of human life as well.
In the case of animals, you said that there is a mind, yeah, but they can't think.
They can't think. That is the difference.
If they do some action, yeah, if they do something wrong,
yeah,
yeah.
Well, there's that possibility. Yeah. I mean, we are so our genes are so close. There is that possibility which we don't know, but there is, we are all made up of the same stuff. Genes, we are all genes, you know. Yeah. Thank you very much for, yeah.
The mind and the consciousness work to be together. Yeah. Because it's consciousness, you know, the same as the memory, all in the brain. And
mind is the energy. It's the energy. Like your iPhone. Your iPhone is only a processor. It can't manufacture anything. It must have energy put into it to operate. And all what you see is that energy being brought into action. Whereas it can't manufacture anything. The cerebellum and the cerebrum and the neurons and all that, you know, it can't manufacture anything. It is processing plant. It's processing. It's a physical entity, as it were. It's not an energy, but consciousness and mind, both are energies. My distinction is that consciousness is everywhere to everybody, whereas mind is personal to you. What you have in your mind right now, no one else in the whole wide world will know. See? It's personal to you. And when you purify that mind, you are happy. By the way, you may have all the money in the bank. You may be having all the best food in the world. You may be with your best relatives that you love. But if your mind is not there, you are not enjoying any of those. That is the value of the mind. Mind is the most important. That is why Buddha said, you can have everything that I own. You can have my palace, my everything. And I am walking away. And that is what it is. But we can't do that. But, you know, there is that possibility of... Well, as many doctors here will certify, until your mind, your heart may have stopped, but until your mind activity comes to a close or completely dead, then only you can be certified as dead. Not the heart. It is the mind. Yeah. I mean, all the cognitive neuroscientists that I have studied, they all say that brain is what we are. We are not brains. It's a physical entity. Yes, sir.
Okay, I found this your talk today quite fascinating. Just a couple of points I want to make.
Yeah.
First, you mentioned this idea about if you have a state of life, you can go to death.
Yeah.
But it so happened that it has come true for me. Let me just tell you what.
The speed of light, you mean?
No, energy. Right?
Energy.
Yeah. Exactly 1 week ago, a friend of mine, a retired eye surgeon friend of mine, wrote to me. She sent to me an article written by another doctor, a Sri Lankan doctor, Dr. Mahendra, something else, I can't remember the second. But he is a neurosurgeon, and he works with, or he has been working with people, elderly people. And basically, he's also referring to the issue of mind and brain. And he was saying in his article, referring to a patient, an Alzheimer's patient, who has lost his personality.
Oh yes, lost the mind.
Asking the question, can that personality, can it come back? Okay? So basically, this article was referred to me, and my friend said, can you please comment on that? And I read that, and based on where I come from, my background, and so forth, and as a young boy, I studied Abhidharma. And then, of course, I did the refresher course of the same thing in the temple on the evening.
Oh, right.
And I have put it together, and also based on my knowledge in the computer science, I have come up with an explanation which is conceptually exactly as what you just told us now. my right artist here, right. Not me cold. So the point where I'm trying to say, and when I, at that point, at that time, I have never heard of you, I have not read any of your books, but simply just visualizing this situation, I have a few. So there's an event, now today I'm listening to you.
I mean, thinking, you know, thinking is very important. That's what, exactly what Buddha said. Don't even the only religious leader in all human history. He said, don't believe as true a single word that I say. You go and test it. And you can test it. If it is not helpful to you, you reject it. As simple as that. And that freedom of inquiry is very important. Yeah.
The only thing is, in my explanation, what I'm trying to say is, this whole idea of, you know, because in the past, for example, you said wrong to speak to the people, and I kept, you know, troubling him as exactly, you know, what is this mind? So we went through this 89 forms of mind.
Oh, yes, 52, yeah. Jesus, yes. Yeah, I don't agree with that. Yeah.
But of course, in my analysis, the mindfulness analysis, where I use the analogy of the computer, what I'm saying is that just like a computer has thought, there are a number of systems in there. You have operating systems. You have the programs.
Yeah.
Then you have the data.
Yeah.
Now, the operating system is very similar to the individual mind.
That's right. Exactly.
And that is because it is because the way it operates is based on your DNA is different from one to the other.
Yeah.
And exactly how that DNA is configured in your body and the way then it works with the energy, which is universally omnipresent energy, is the
same. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the way it vibrates within you, in your form energy, something quite unique.
Yeah. I have, you know, I wrote the book and I was just waiting until something, that's why I said about Daniel Dennett. I revere him very much. And there are so many philosophers against him, scientists against him. But he's adamant that the human brain is a computer and it's hardware and the software is the mind. Without the mind, that's it. I mean, it falls into place, but it's food for thought, really. I mean, that is what, there are different opinions. And we have to sort out one day, of course, that's why I said to begin with, I say that somebody will pick this up, and someday it will emerge that we are only our minds. And it's a long way to go, still. Yeah, that is what it is. Yeah, anything that... Yeah, anybody else? But I can't...
What about this telepathy in general? I mean, somebody is so far away and you try to connect it.
Yeah.
And they transmit the energy or something like that. Yeah, your theory is right because it means that the other person receiving the energy.
Yeah. Communicate with each other. There are possibilities. Yeah, I mean this book has created, I was told, a furore among the learned neuroscientists who are hell bent on trying to prove that brain is the most vital part of it. We don't deny that. But it is only a physical entity. And it needs some energy to work. So it's not end. We have not reached the end yet. It's a long way to go. But, yes? Oh, yes.
So
intelligent, yeah. I mean, the funny thing is, a lion doesn't eat a cub. His own cub, he won't eat. I mean, these are things that are ingrained into into the genetic structure. They only do. There are squirrels who perform absolutely unbelievable tasks to get the food. Because there is only one tunnel mind. They are only interested in that food, how to get it. And that, once you get that food, it ends there. That whole process ends. With us, it doesn't end. It stays in us. So every time they come, they go through the whole process again. See, I mean, the animals can't. My argument is only animals can't. Only we can commit suicide. I'm going to kill myself. And you can kill yourself. Whereas animal can't get to that level of exterminating himself or herself or itself. It just can't do that. Somehow or other. That's one way that I have tried to argue in the book. Yeah, I mean, you know, we have to depend on some examples to, this is one of the examples. The thinking mind is what is, we are all here because of thinking mind. You know, I mean, think about 3,000 years ago. All were having cholera, diphtheria, so many illnesses, and we died en masse. And bubonic plague here in London. And all, we came out of all that because of our thinking mind. Bye. Okay, Alan. Yeah. See you. Yeah, so there we are. That's how I'm only, I have done about 20 years of work. I have learned quite a lot, but still there are certain nagging doubts here and there, mind is a very important subject, I think, and it is a very, very difficult subject. I mean, you heard the definition put together by an eminent team of scientists. I can't understand it. It's regulating the flow of information and energy. Why regulating what? I don't know. But then the Buddha description of the mind, hamdruni kohomada yanne duiga durangamang ilangata guhasayan guhasayan. See, 2600 years ago. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah, maybe. See how. Yeah. That's right, yeah. 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 I don't think so. Well, it's my opinion on it. Yeah. Yeah, they have minds. Yeah, they have minds, definitely. Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is it.
I mean, for example, you know, what could make the human being commit suicide? Because the emotion is a very large
part. Yeah. To take your own life, to terminate your own life is a very big act against consciousness. I mean, you are terminating consciousness. That's what you are doing. The mind is so powerful that it can terminate the creation of this body. The neurons have.
Yeah.
I mean that famous story where he was able to recognize his Ford Fiesta, but not his own wife right in front of him. I mean that would have been a hell of a situation, because that particular part of the neurons dealing with face recognition, because it is absolutely vital for us to know. That is why it is given a special, you know, dedicated number of neurons to deal with it. Because you need to recognize the faces to live. Two different things, yeah. Yeah, no. Once the consciousness dies, the mind can't exist. That is the end of it. End of the... Yeah. No. It's the mind that is going. Yeah, mind. It's not the consciousness. Consciousness is everywhere. But mind is your mind. Do I know what is in your mind right now? Nobody will know. Nobody can know. That is why Ekacharang. The mind, my mind only works with me. When, as I said before, consciousness means you are dead. If you are not conscious, you are dead. But if you are not, your mind is not working properly, you live. You are conscious. But you cease to become or behave an operational unit of a human being. Yeah, you have to be looked after by others. You can't. Because your mind has gone. Yeah, but your consciousness is there. You can eat, you can drink, you can sleep, you can do all kinds of things. But no, it is the mind that is doing everything. Yeah, because by deductive logic, if without the mind you can't behave like a human being, then mind is the one that is important. It's not... I mean, that is my humble view. It may be wrong, but that is how it is. That's what I think is. And that is what Buddha has said as well. I mean, that explanation, durang gamangan, absolutely incredible.